And let us now take up our preaching text, Psalm 83 today, beginning on page 492 in your pew Bible. A song, a psalm of Asaph. O God, do not keep silence, do not hold your peace or be still, O God. For behold, your enemies make an uproar. Those who hate you have raised their heads. They lay crafty plans against your people. They consult together against your treasured ones. They say, come, let us wipe them out as a nation. Let the name of Israel be remembered no more. For they conspire with one accord against you. They make a covenant, tents of Edom, and the Ishmaelites, Moab and Hagarites, Gebel and Ammon and Amalek, Philistia with the inhabitants of Tyre, Ashur also has joined them. They are the strong arm of the children of Lot, Selah. Do to them as you did to Midian, as to Sisera and Jabin at the river Kishon, who were destroyed at Endor, who became dung for the ground. Make their nobles like Oreb and Zeb, all their princes like Zeba and Zalmunna, who said, let us take possession for ourselves of the pastures of God. O my God, make them like whirling dust, like chaff before the wind. As fire consumes the forest, as the flame sets the mountains ablaze, so may you pursue them with your tempest and terrify them with your hurricane. Fill their faces with shame that they may seek your name, O Lord. Let them be put to shame and dismayed forever. Let them perish in disgrace that they may know that you alone, whose name is the Lord, are the Most High over all the earth. Kind of daunting, all these withering texts here today, isn't it? How important is it for the Christian to hate? Should we even hate? What is it precisely that we should hate if we are to? The Oxford English Dictionary defines hate as an emotion of extreme dislike or revulsion, detestation, abhorrence, the opposite of love, to bear ill will or malice against. Strong stuff. Yet the topic before us today, the community psalm of lament, imprecation, drinks deeply of this very thing, hatred. Imprecation means to cast a curse, to pronounce a curse upon someone or something. This is why our questions are so important. Should we hate? If so, what should we hate? How can we be sure we hate what God hates? In the late 18th century, two revolutions took place. Maybe this will help put this in perspective for us. Two revolutions in the 18th century. The French Revolution and the American Revolution. One hated the tyranny of monarchy. The other hated the monarchs of tyranny. There's a difference. Can you guess which was which? Can you guess which produced justice and which produced just another tyranny? The American Revolution declared no king but Christ. The French Revolution crowned godless reason as queen over France. The American Revolution created a brand new thing, a written constitution to guide her triumph over monarchy. The French Revolution also created a brand new thing, the guillotine, to guide her triumph over monarchy. There was no such thing. They needed a more efficient way of killing all of these monarchs and bluebloods. And so a man invented the guillotine, not until Cyclone B was there, invented by the Nazis in the gas chambers, was there a more efficient way of killing than the guillotine. The American Revolution produced a man of integrity, George Washington, who refused to be crowned king by the people. Well, the French Revolution also produced a man of tyranny. Can you tell me, you young students of history, who the French Revolution eventually produced was Napoleon Bonaparte, who crowned himself the new Holy Roman Emperor. The motto of the American Revolution was resistance to tyrants as obedience to God. The motto of the French Revolution, the government of the revolution is liberty's despotism against tyranny. Liberty's despotism? That sounds like an oxymoron, doesn't it? Pronounced by Robespierre. Robespierre, eventually a victim of his own revolution. He was eventually beheaded himself. Again, both revolutions evidenced hatred. One against the tyranny of monarchs, hating the very idea and principle of tyranny, killing those who attempted to impose these ideas and principles on them. The other revolution hated the monarchs of tyranny, hating first the men and only secondarily the idea and principle. Can you see the difference? Which is just? Which is evil and unjust? If you can distinguish the vast gulf which separates these two revolutions, then you will be able to distinguish between a psalm of imprecation and just another jihadist screed. One is holy, expressing the eternal will of God against evil. The other is just another evil rant against an object of hate. Well, which is which? How do we distinguish between the two? This takes true biblical wisdom. You must couple the idea of an imprecatory psalm with biblical wisdom. Let's look at our text here for a few moments. Look at imprecation. That is the pronouncement of a curse. Imprecation. The community curses its would-be captors, peoples seemingly without number, verses 1 through 8. Today we embark upon a sea of psalms. The evangelical church would rather ignore and forget. That is the imprecatory psalms. How embarrassing, really. Even the OPC, no stranger to controversy, discomfort among the spineless evangelical world, even the OPC omits the imprecatory psalms from its readings. So that's why we have our insert here today. Jesus says, love your enemies, do good to those who spitefully use you. These psalms say, let them perish in disgrace. Damn them, if you will. Jesus says, blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. These psalms say, blessed shall be he who takes your little ones and dashes them against the rock. Do these sentiments not seem to be diametrically opposed? Do we not have to jettison one or the other point of view if we hold one of them? The New Testament, at surface glance, at first glance, seems to promulgate a turn-the-other-cheek mentality, direct opposition to smash another's cheek in the Old Testament. Are they not in conflict? How are we to reconcile them if we hope to salvage anything from them? The answers have generally been along the lines of four different answers. What do we do with the imprecatory psalms? Number one, the imprecatory psalms express a prediction, not a preference for the sinner's doom. St. Augustine first advanced this view, hoping to evade the difficulty of having to hate in the Christian scheme of things. He adopted the supposed philosopher's distance and objectivity from the question, thinking that David and Asaph and Israel, somehow detached from the affairs of God in redemptive history. But that's merely an evasion, I would submit to you, as many others have pointed out as well. Unlike the feelings and the thoughts of the Psalms themselves, they don't have the philosopher's distance or objectivity from these things. No, they're passionately involved, are they not? So this view isn't held much anymore. Another view of the imprecatory Psalms is that they express a purely spiritual sense, whose enemies are by no means really before us. There's an element of truth in this. We do face spiritual foes at every hand. Ephesians chapter 6 points this out. Revelation is fond of doing this as well. And yet, as J.W. Webster, an excellent book, The Psalms and Worship, he does a section on the imprecatory Psalms. He says, Saul, Doeg, Ahithophel, and others of like character were very much and very banefully in evidence in the flesh. And we live in a simultaneously spiritual and physical creation, don't we? Our spiritual enemies inevitably manifest themselves in the physical creation. So, they're not just strictly spiritual imprecations being cast here. A third view is that the imprecatory Psalms express a personal vindictiveness unfit for the covenantal dispensation we are now in, for the new covenant. And this is probably the most prevalent today. Here lies one of the most egregious errors of theology, too, I would submit to you. If you don't know the imprecatory Psalms, then you don't know grace either, I would submit. But this view says, well, the Old Testament is primitive and barbaric. The New Testament is enlightened and advanced and sophisticated. The Old Testament is God in his infancy. Once again, you see the evolutionary doctrine here at work. The New Testament is God more fully aware and mature. The Old Testament God of vengeance is in the process of evolving into the New Testament God of forgiveness and grace. This is very short-sighted, though, and I think deficient, very shallow. In the first place, grace suffuses the Old Testament. Who was more gracious to his enemies and more forgiving than Joseph or David or the persecuted prophets? And who was more condemnatory and judgmental towards sin and hypocrisy than Jesus? And no one spoke more of judgment and hell than Christ either, in all the Bible. Well, the fourth view, then, is that the imprecatory Psalms are a cry for justice against atrocity, a revulsion towards evil, and a plea for vindicating the innocent victims of evil. Can you guess which has been lighted upon as the biblical view? Let me repeat that one. The imprecatory Psalms are a cry for justice against evil, a revulsion towards evil, and a plea for vindicating the innocent victims of evil. And here I think we see the true heart of the imprecatory Psalm. It lies close to the heart of God, I would submit to you too. God loves justice and righteousness. The imprecatory Psalms are a cry for God's justice and righteousness. He hates evil. In fact, he hates the evil one. Psalm 7:11 says in the King James, God judges the righteous and God is angry with the wicked every day. The corollary of love of righteousness is a hatred of evil. If you do not hate evil, I would submit to you, then you do not love righteousness either. Can one exist without the other? Can you love the smell of sizzling steak and the dog pile simultaneously? No. Can you love good without hating evil? The imprecatory Psalm gives expression to this. The imprecatory Psalm hates what God hates, evil and those who embrace and impose it upon the righteous. The cry of this Psalm and others like it is the same as that of the souls under the altar of God, slain in witness to the gospel in Revelation chapter 6. They cried out with a loud voice, O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you will judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? So make no mistake, evil has no smidgen of love for anything but wickedness and its master, the evil one. Evil is implacable It never stops, never gives up, shows no quarter. It hates God and his program. It hates Christ and his people, the church. It has done so since the opening day in the garden, intending to waste and destroy the seed of the woman down to the Christ. The motive of these in our psalm is identical with that of the serpent in the garden, Pharaoh at the Red Sea, Herod with the slaughter of the innocents in Bethlehem, and that is to waste and destroy the people and program of God. Behold, your enemies make an uproar. These are of the same cloth as those just mentioned. Those who hate you, that is the living God, have raised their heads. They lay crafty plans against your people. They consult together against your treasured ones. Echoed here is the theme of Psalm 2. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. Once again, we see Christ in the Psalms, do we not? To conspire against Israel, to conspire against God's king, is to conspire against the Christ. To slaughter God's people now, to butcher Christians in Iraq, to persecute them in North Korea and China. There was a missionary just released this week, was there not? From a prison in North Korea. What do they want? We have to ask, right? The psalmist articulates a roster of enemies here that reads like a who's who of treachery and betrayal. Edom translates red after Esau and his red hair and his red meat stew. Jacob's rejected brother becomes an inconsolable enemy of Israel as they flourish and blossom into a nation. The Ishmaelites, the brother of Isaac, once again Ishmael, also rejected by God as inheritor of the promise. Moab and the Hagarites. Moab was, of course, the son of Lot by incestuous union with his daughter. And the Hagarites, a little-known tribe descending perhaps from Hagar. Not sure about that. Possible. Then we have Gebel, Ammon, and Amalek. These three were located, this was the southern coalition. Gebel and the Amalekites being wandering tribes. Amalek, Israel's oldest enemy besides Egypt. And then Ammon, of course, was the other son of Lot by his daughter. Then we have Philistia. When Jewish blood was to be shed, the Philistines could be counted on to be there, right? They indeed progenitors of modern Palestine. Palestine is a version of Philistia. And then there's Ashur. This is a collective noun denominating the coalition of states under the sway of Assyria. Even as Russia uses states like Crimea, Russian Ukraine, or we use South Korea or the Philippines as client states, so Assyria used all of these listed above to conquer further. Very clever. Thus they are the strong arm of the children of Lot, that is Moab and Ammon. So, with this intimidating coalition of blood enemies before her, implacable, hating God first and foremost, Israel called upon God then not to keep silence. Don't hold your peace or be still. Instead, speak, thunder, blast your voice like the trumpet blast that issued from Sinai when all of Israel swore that it would slay them. All of these peoples are types and shadows of Satan's people. All through Scripture, there's something, though the names are different, the peoples are different, the races are different, the ethnicities are different. There's something about their motive, their actions, the foaming at the mouth, hatred of God and his people that is the same. Types and shadows of Satan's people. Open your eyes today. Look out upon the world today. Perhaps even as we speak here today, there are those being slaughtered by the Muslim butchers in Iraq, the dictators of North Korea and China, or the atheistic plutocrats of the West. They hate you and the Christians of Christ Church, and they hate them with as much venom as those hated in Israel. They want you dead and in hell as decisively as the ancient descendant of Israel's seed of the serpent. Make no mistake about this. So Israel would take up this psalm to sing in lament. This is a psalm of lament at heart, only it imprecates, that is, pronounces a curse in the will and heart of God upon those enemies. And Israel would take up this psalm in community to sing in lament at critical times in her history when she was threatened. Well, then, what is to be done with them? What is the imprecation? What is to be done with them? Verses 9 through 12. Imprecation. The community curses its would-be captors that they perish with the vanquished. That they perish with the vanquished. In singing this psalm, Israel would remember God's strength in her own weakness. Meant to evoke for us, too, God's strength in our weakness. Derek Kidner says, at this juncture, he says, the past comes to life here in prayer and faith. That was what was intended, too, with these psalms of lament. The community was indeed to have the past come to life in prayer and faith. The community, the Old Testament church, as well as us, would remember God's faithfulness in the past, in vanquishing her enemies, and they would take courage for the present. And here she remembers two campaigns from the book of Judges, Asaph does, recalls for them, first of all, Gideon's defeat of the Midianites, which we read in a rather lengthy passage, didn't we not, from the book of Judges this morning. The victory was complete, was it not, humiliating for this coalition of tribes? And then secondly, the other campaign, Deborah and Barak's defeat of Sisera and Jabin. As we saw recently, Sisera came to a graphic end, didn't he, having his head be an anchor for a church campout as a tent stake was driven through it by Jael? Can or will God reprise his power again? As Jerusalem is surrounded by enemies again, will he come to our aid? He's bidden to do that. To them, to these guys, what he'd done to former enemies. There is no love for enemies here, no quarter for those who hate the God of Israel as much or more than his people. It's in perfect line with New Testament sentiments, I submit to you as well, that hate evil and hate evildoers. Peter was not very loving and forgiving to Ananias and Sapphira, was he? When he exclaimed, this imprecation, may your money perish with you, and they dropped dead. Paul was not very loving and forgiving when he pronounced an imprecation, anathema, that is, be damned, upon any Galatian who preached another gospel than that preached by him. For that matter, Jesus was not very loving and forgiving when he drove out the money changers from the temple or pronounced imprecations against the scribes and the Pharisees. All this now having been said, this doctrine must be handled with true biblical wisdom. With true biblical wisdom. I would look askance at somebody who was too eager to pronounce imprecations at every turn. Just as there were two revolutions in the 18th century, so there are two ways to imprecate. Righteous and true, one sinful and false. Do you hate evil and unrighteousness with a holy hatred? As you learn to love holiness, as you learn to love the holy Christ, you are also revulsed by sin. You reject it. You learn to hate it, if you will. Well, then these psalms are yours. These psalms are yours and ours as a community. Do you hate another for selfish and vindictive reasons? and therefore imprecate. Then you'll be one day or another the object of imprecatory psalms. That's the irony. Handle these then with true biblical wisdom. Do you long for the vindication of those who suffer for righteousness' sake, seeking also the vindication of God's glory? Then these psalms are yours. Do you secretly hate and vilify God's people and church, seeking rather to glorify self? Then you too will one day be an object of these imprecatory psalms. You must have a clear head about this. Wisdom will make clear when the Christian extends mercy and forgiveness to an enemy. In the spirit of the Sermon on the Mount, wisdom will also tell you when, conversely, he prays in imprecatory psalm against incorrigible, implacable foes of Christ and his gospel. Almost a year after this guy did it, a co-worker came to me to apologize and ask forgiveness for mocking my faith. I'd forgotten about it, to tell you the truth, but it had bothered him. So we extend forgiveness, do we not? I pray for the fanatical, demonic Muslims who hate me and hate my faith. I hope that I would be able to cry out, indeed, if they were to slay me, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. I hope I could be that kind of man that could do that. But I also have no hesitation in praying an imprecatory psalm like this against Muhammad and his religion of peace, and those who faithfully execute it. Longing for the day when God will make an end of these kinds of things, religions like these, false religions, idolatrous religions, and establish the true religion on all the earth. I pray for this too. And they're not contrary sentiments. They're not contradictory. They can coexist in the same heart. They coexist in the heart of God, and they can coexist in our heart as well. Well, in the day of the temple, when the people sang this psalm, as it concludes here sweetly, doesn't it? The pastures of God. These are after the pastures of God. The pastures of God in that day were literal, dotted throughout Israel, were they not? Today, as these psalms speak of Christ, the pastures of God are those places of safety in the bosom of God, under the altar for those martyred, for example, all for whom he is yet jealous to keep and protect. The New Testament uses terms like my church, right? My sheep, he says in John chapter 10, God's temple, 1 Corinthians 3. And he will defend us against all of his and our enemies. Imprecation. He will destroy his and our enemies. Well, verses 13 to 18 then. Imprecation. The community curses its would-be captors that they might know who is Most High. Once again, there is something cathartic. There is something encouraging as well as the community participates in this psalm of lament, technically a psalm of lament. All men will one day know that Yahweh is Most High over the earth, will they not? Scriptures testify to this constantly from Genesis to Revelation. They will either know that Yahweh is Most High as one of his children, who humbly loves and serves him, or they will know that he is Most High because they are vanquished foes who have tasted his wrath. For these latter ones, the community of God sings this lament, imprecating those who hate him and his people. There are evil people out there who know full well the living God exists. They struggle and fight against him anyway, hate him, and serve evil instead. There are people like that out there. For them, we sing this lament, imprecating those who hate him with full knowledge, hate him and his people. You ever met one? Asaph uses familiar metaphors for utter defeat. Don't be naive. There are people like this out there. And Asaph uses familiar metaphors for utter defeat that derive not only from desert culture and climate, but also from the language of the Exodus. Sirocco winds, for example. Hurricane. I'm not even sure why the ESV uses hurricane here. This is more like the desert winds, the desert Sirocco winds. An Israelite or a Jew would say, hurricane. What's a hurricane? Hurricane's over water, isn't it? No, Sirocco winds would lash the desert, sometimes for days at a time, sending sand blowing as if God's sandblaster, if you will. Destroy them like this, Lord. Destroy them like a Sirocco storm. We also understand the power of fire, right? In our own region, we understand the power of fire. Destroy them like a forest fire, rages through the mountains, rages through the forests. Drive through Yellowstone. You can still see the effects of the Yellowstone blaze of 88, can't you? We know the power of fire in our region, the power of fire. Destroy your enemies like this, O Lord. The community bids God to vanquish their enemies in these manners. The purpose? That they may seek your name. That they may know that you alone are the Most High. That they may seek your name. Destroy them that they may seek your name. That doesn't seem to be a carrot. That's quite a stick, is it not? It is done, though, as their faces are filled with shame. They are dismayed. They are perishing in disgrace, the text says. Kidner says, with a little bit of restraint here, he says, verse 16 comes to the brink of praying for the enemy's conversion. And you get the sense from Kidner that maybe we shouldn't imprecate them. Maybe we should do that. Push them over the edge here. Pray for their salvation rather than their imprecation. Verse 16 comes to the brink of praying for the enemy's conversion, but the ruling thought is of God's vindication rather than man's conversion. That's more to the point. The ruling thought is God's vindication rather than man's conversion. But there's still no contradiction here, because oftentimes with conquest comes conversion. Look at Japan after World War II, realizing indeed they were vanquished by a better foe and adopted the culture and economy of that conquering foe, did they not? Did so willingly, openly. Who prospered more after World War II than Japan under Western-style capitalism and democracy? You say the same for South Korea, India, too, as a British colony, finally coming out of darkness in that regard. My favorite is Charlemagne and the Saxons, though. Now, this doesn't always work. I don't always recommend sending out missionaries in the fashion that Charlemagne did. But he sent his troops to the Saxons, lined all their chieftains up, cut off their heads, and told the rest to get baptized. They did. They got baptized, but they didn't embrace Christianity with a kind of sincerity that pleased Charlemagne. So he went back, cut off more heads, and said, get baptized again. This time it took. The Saxons have been Christians ever since. Now, I don't always, sometimes I lean towards that method. But that's not the New Testament method, is it? In essence and in heart. But this psalm, then, is now ours. Sometimes with conquering comes conversion, though. Sometimes with conquering comes conversion. So this psalm is now ours, brothers and sisters. And we're not the first to blow off the dust and employ it. Webster in his piece again, and I just encourage you to read it. He does a good job of vindicating, of re-embracing the church, having the church re-embrace these psalms. He says, occasions abundantly justifying their proper use are to be found in the history of the church. And he goes through and cites a few of these. He says, for example, when the Spanish Armada, I I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago as well. When the Spanish Armada swept down on the shores of England, pious and patriotic hearts united in that mighty war song, "Let God arise, let his enemies be scattered, let them also that hate him flee before him." Mentions of several other instances too. The Waldenses used these imprecatory psalms. And the oppressed Covenanters. Remember, we dealt extensively with that. The Scottish Covenanters used these imprecatory psalms as well. One I was not aware of, though, one that might be illumined a little more in American history, says, "Men of every shade of religious belief, men of every shade of religious belief," and he says, "the fact is notorious, turn to them in the days of our own civil war." So these imprecatory psalms were also used in our own civil war. That was new to me. So these psalms are now ours. They have been employed and used by the church. Don't be squeamish about using them. Examine your own heart and mind to make sure you're doing so righteously. Otherwise, you will bring imprecations on yourself. You must be repentant. You must use biblical wisdom in knowing when to use them. And you're using them according to biblical principles and not according to your own selfish hatred and lusts. But these psalms then, the imprecatory psalms as well, are now ours. Christ will one day be established as Lord, will he not? The Most High over all the earth. Let us sing this psalm in anticipation of that day, because indeed the Psalms of Lamentation, the community Psalms of Lamentation, including the imprecatory psalms, are now ours. Well, let us now come to that place then where we do find community in one who endured imprecations for us as we participate in his body and blood in the supper of the Lord.